Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code BROS. Forget the one-size-fits-all supplements that you can only get high on. We're done with that, all right? Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood that you're looking for, whether that's the Mind Magic gummies for deep work and creativity, or the PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full body experience. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days, but Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get to that perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with the code BROS. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use the promo code BROS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
Looking for something new? Try fencing, the Olympic and Paralympic sport that mixes speed, strategy, and fun. It's like chess meets cardio. Quick feet, quick decisions, and a satisfying beep when you score a point. Kids, teens, and adults can start anytime. No experience needed, and many clubs have loaner gear. Coaches teach fundamentals and safety from day one. Find a beginner class near you at usafencing.org/tryfencing. That's usafencing.org/tryfencing.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Welcome to Drinking Bros. D'Anthony, we have a smarter guest than you today.
I know, it's nice. Usually we have imbeciles on the show.
Yes,
you and others. And
correct. Dummies, porn stars, Oscar winners who are also dumb. You know,
I mean, I feel like Matthew McConaughey is pretty smart.
He's a pretty smart guy.
Yeah.
Pretty smart guy. Not on Brian Keating's level.
No.
Brian, you're a professor of cosmology. When did you get into makeup?
Yeah, you can tell from my appearance, my coiffure, that it's... especially important to me, right?
It's funny.
I usually say to people I'm a physicist, and they say, that's why you're so bulked up. Phys ed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's our booking agent, Ari, actually did write cosmetology accidentally in the email.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, I was going to talk shit to him. I was like, I'll let that one go.
I'm sure it happens all of the time.
It's just Apple auto-correcting.
Yeah, it's all it is. Because there's not a lot of people who are in cosmology.
That's right.
Tell our audience who might not know what that is exactly what being a professor of cosmology is.
Well, normally, first of all, this show is like rated G, or I can't curse or anything.
You can say anything you want.
You can literally say anything you want.
You know,
just
better.
Just the opposite of the faculty club. All right, cool.
You can't talk about the election, though. We found that out on YouTube. Anything but the election.
Yeah,
you're good to go.
Or there's a certain, you know, something that rhymes with televid or anyway, we won't talk about that either.
I'm not
that kind of doctor, although I will prescribe medication if you guys are good.
Oh, really? Yeah, we always like medication.
Yeah, we love it over here. If you can throw some Viking in our way, kick that on down the bunny trail, we'll be good to go, my man.
So yeah, typically when people meet me, they're like, oh cool, you're an astronomer, you know, I'm a Pisces. And I used to say, what the fuck? Give me a freaking break, man. But now, you know what I do? I say, you know what? Your horoscope, it's troubling. You know, that lump on your ass, that's cancer, buddy.
Yeah.
You better get that taken care of.
Go to WebMD. Can you imagine WebMD and hypochondriacs in 2020 and 21.
Oh, it'd be great.
Holy shit, dude. Yeah. They should make a reality. Like, fuck all this my 600-pound life stuff. Mm-hmm. I want to see hypochondriacs on WebMD all day. That's what I want to see
right now. So do I. And Pisces is a water sign, by the way. So I know
that is true.
You name the only thing that I actually am.
Wait, Pisces is a water sign. That's early or late February, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So is that when he was born too?
I don't know. Yeah, is that when you were born?
No. I'm not a Pisces. I don't discriminate against them. They're actually good connections between astrology, astronomy, cosmology, and cosmetology. And we'll talk about the original question, which was about cosmetology, which you guys are expert in too, as I can tell. You're Manscaped to the extreme. Yeah, although you got to get them as a sponsor. They offered to sponsor my podcast. How can they not be a sponsor of your podcast?
They were for many, many years. Yeah. Dan's holding up the dop kit.
Oh, nice.
There.
The bag, the lawnmower, whatever. Yeah. They're actually in San Diego, those brothers. Yeah.
They're cool.
Great.
We like those guys.
I thought, you know, for my brand, such as it is, you know, my brand should be telescopes, microscopes, lab coats. So I decided against it. You know, Ari advised me against it. But anyway, cosmology. So cosmos means, and I know you guys are scholars of ancient Greek. I don't have to tell you that, but it means face or beauty or appearance. And that's because the night sky, you know, where you guys are, where I am, you look up at the night sky, it's freaking beautiful. Mm. You look at it and you have a connection to the otherworldly. And so there's a connection between your face, the appearance that you present to the universe, which has a different meaning. So they are connected through that meaning. Of course, there's nothing in common with them. And people do mistake that. They mistake me for an astrologer way more often than a cosmetologist. Although one of my daughters wants me to do her nails much more frequently than I will admit to being curious about.
Look, we're all curious. It's whether or not you've actually had it in, you know? Or taking that curiosity to the next level. Obviously, your curiosity in life led you to become, I feel like you're like the just world-renowned dude who you got a book, losing the Nobel Prize. Like, I feel like you're one of those guys who will win eventually one day.
Well,
real. Like, and it's weird to say.
It is become just like the Academy Awards. There's some political element to it at this point, which is whenever you introduce things like profit motive or identity in politics into things that are fucking science, like healthcare and education and this, it always becomes problematic, right?
Yeah.
And that's why you wrote your book, right? Because it's mostly political behind the scenes, and the wrong people are getting the awards, and it's discouraging young scientists and everything else. You can speak more on that, obviously. But it is interesting because, you know, once a year, the Nobel Prize pops up. You see all these people nominated, and you're like, wow, what a weird list of people that they've actually chosen for this, but who actually deserve it? And it's, chances are it's probably guys like you, but it usually goes to somebody else.
Yeah, well, so for a long time, you know, it wouldn't go to people like me because, like our brother Ari, I am of the Semitic persuasion.
Yeah.
And actually, Jews were forbidden to get it for a long time. Actually, Einstein, brother Einstein, he did not receive the Nobel Prize for something like 17 years after he came up with a little thing called the theory of relativity.
Well,
yeah, no big
general,
deal.
General and special. So the miracle year for the audience, the miracle year of 1905 when he published these four papers. It wasn't until, 1919 did he actually win, or 1920? I think the experiment where he took pictures of the sun and the light bending around it because of mass and gravity and that, whatever the fuck. I think it was 20 that he actually won, and 19 that they took the pictures or something
actually,
like that.
Actually, can you fill in? I'm teaching in about an hour. Dan, do you mind, you know, just like filling in? That was
if anybody pulled out a camera phone and recorded the presentation that I would give, you would lose your job for sure.
Yes, yes. Be a lot of dicks drawn on that chalkboard.
Yeah. Just hidden dicks. That's the name of my presentation.
Yeah, so for many years, it wasn't possible. And even now, it's very political. How it's given. But actually, the book was more, you know, the book has three chapters. I happen to have a copy of the book right here. I'll send you guys a copy. So you see the book cover, there are these three kind of, remember like when you're a kid, do you guys ever do Choose Your Own Adventures when you were a kid?
All the time,
I love those freaking books, man. So I wanted it to be an adventure possibility where if you didn't give a crap about the Nobel Prize and you just want to learn about the, you know, come for the cosmology, maybe not stay for the Nobel Prize, I said, publisher, please print the cover. Please print the borders of the only three chapters about the Nobel Prize. Print them in gray. And they're like, sure. And I didn't know. I'd never written a book before. But the rest of the book is a memoir. It's really a memoir of what it feels like to seek, to strive, you know, and not to yield, even though you come up short. Because let's face it, you know, the Super Bowl is this weekend, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. So who even Tom Brady isn't in the Super Bowl this Sunday, right?
No, he is.
He is. Okay, fine. So he is.
But that's crazy, right? That defies every form of logic in every sport ever. He's been in 10 out of the last 20.
Exactly, which is crazy, but he hasn't been out of 20 out of the last 20, right? So sometimes he's had to come as close as you can humanly get and fail and then sit with that for at least a year, sometimes longer. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about that. I was like, how many people out there, you know, aspire to win the Nobel Prize? Very few, but how many out there aspire to make partner at the law firm, to make, you know, top dog realtor, to make, you know, 82nd Airborne, right? Whatever. And they come up short. That doesn't mean they're losers, right? I mean, I lost it technically. Does that mean I'm a loser? Yeah, if I don't learn any mistakes and humility from it, then I am a loser. But the point is, I wanted to write a book about what does it feel like to compete at an elite level, come up short, but say, I'm going to dust myself off literally from the cosmic dust and come back stronger than ever, better than ever, and, you know, use it as a message of resiliency. So only three chapters are about the Nobel Prize. It's not really about the Peace Prize so much. I will refer you to a super gal who wrote a book about the losing the Nobel Prize of the Peace Prize and how evil, distorted, and wretched it's been. And you know what's funny about that book? So after you write a book, I don't know if you guys ever wrote any books. You plan to write any books? Dan, your cosmology textbook I'm going to get.
My last one might have been number one in the world, but who's counting? You know, 9 straight weeks in the New York Times bestseller list. Yes, I've written a couple. Maybe a couple.
I don't know if you knew that in advance, but I hate you for allowing him to go.
I love it so much.
I wanted to let him gloat. Come on.
I love it so much. Thank you so much. You're my favorite person now, Brian.
But imagine if you write your next book and it doesn't get on any list, or it's like it's not. So the point is, even if you make it, you know, in my religion, Moses, he's greatest humble man who ever, he never got to the promised land. So how many of us don't get into the promised land? And so you actually spend more of your time. You know, I'm a pilot, private pilot in my limited amount of spare time. And, you know, there's a notion that if you fight a headwind, flying from Austin to Dallas, I don't know, maybe that's an hour flight, and it's 100-mile-an-hour headwind, and then you come back right around and go back to Austin from Dallas, and it's 100-mile-an-hour tailwind. Naively, most people, even physicists, I ask that too. Does it take the same 1 hour plus 1 hour, namely 2 hours? And they'll say yes, but it doesn't. Because imagine if it's like 500-mile-an-hour tailwind on the way there. You're like, yeah, I get there in half the time. But then on the way back, you make zero progress. In other words, you're going to spend more time of your life in a headwind, battling a headwind, than you will benefit from the tailwinds of your previous successes. So enjoy the resistance of the headwind and just enjoy the process. That's what I came out learning from this experience.
Right.
Man, I have a problem with that.
Well, I'm more of a...
I hated the process.
I'm more of a don't fight the current kind of guy, right? I mean, anybody that's an accomplished swimmer, or anybody that's done rescue swimming, or anybody that teaches anything like that, knows that fighting against the current is ultimately, I mean, you have to understand what life is, right? I mean, there's some things you can control and some things you cannot control.
Yes.
And for the New York Times bestseller list, for example, despite the fact that his book was selling the most copies for weeks and weeks and weeks in a row, it was still only what I think it was.
It peaked at number five.
Number five.
Although it was number one by like 20,000. I mean, it was a 13,000 copies, right, in the world. And problem with it is the New York Times bestseller list, what everybody strives to, is a curated list.
Which is a good analog. That's a good analog for media in general these days, because media, particularly cable news, has become a curated set of facts, which is not facts, right? Information is not curated. Information is information.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It is all relevant in some way or another. So you don't get to choose like... an avenue of information and ignore all the rest. That doesn't make sense. That's confirmation bias. And that's what we in science always try to avoid. That's the number one thing we try to avoid. is confirmation bias, right?
And the greatest scientists in history have succumbed to it. And, you know, all the more so us. You know, I have all these finger puppets here. I like to finger the great scientist. So sue me. So Galileo, he's my hero. Actually, I just got the rights, the permission to translate. Can you believe this? Galileo wrote one of the best books in human history. It's called The Dialogue About the Two Different World Systems. And he was battling forces ranging from, in truth, the church a little bit, but also his other scientists who believed that the earth was the center of the universe. Right. That was a natural. I mean, if I ask you guys are, you know, like educated people, you're not physicists, but if I say prove to me, you know, sometimes I do this with my kids. I'll say, what's 6 times 7? They'll say 42. I'll say, no, it's not. And I make them actually go through it. And that process of going through and proving it is true. But if I ask you, prove that the earth is in motion around the sun, how would you do it?
Shadows on the ground. That's how we originally discovered it, right?
That's like, the curvature of the earth. You're right. 100% right. But that, I'm talking about the motion of the earth around the sun.
Yeah, I would go. So we're friends with Kyrie Irving, who's a flat earther. And, you know, I'd probably call Kyrie. I understand what you're saying. And to go back to this process, like a guy as brilliant as you, like, because me personally, what I was saying was I hated the process, and I still do. I hate the journey and everybody who says that shit to me. Like, if you're talented enough in your field and you hit whatever marker you're supposed to hit, you should be number one and get that thing, whatever that thing is. I guess my question is this, because you're an unbelievably fascinating guy. We had a guy on, high school football coach, Kevin Kelly, on a couple of days ago. The winningest high school football coach in
yeah,
high school
show.
Right now. He was fantastic.
Yeah.
And he's able to go out every year and be number one, and there is a number by it, and nothing can beat that, right? And things that we do, writing in particular, or the Nobel Prize, right? It's somebody else's shit that you have to deal with, and whether or not they're going to allow you to be number one. How do you enjoy that process when it is clearly flawed and it's not truly who the best is?
It'd be different if it was your peers deciding, right? I think the same thing about like the most valuable player award in any major sport. I would much rather hear what the players have to think than what some old ass, or the Hall of Fame in baseball especially.
Right. Yeah,
like these old ass dudes that have never played baseball in their life decide who is and isn't worthy of a Hall of Fame induction.
And it's worse with the Nobel Prize. It's like, you know, 500 mostly dudes in Sweden, you know, many of whom were notoriously anti-Semitic. In fact, one of the ways that you do, you know, possibly win this, unless, you know, someone comes into your office who is a Nobel Prize winner and leaves it on the couch when you're doing a podcast with him.
Is that true?
That's how I got that one. But actually, you know, it's interesting because in general, they get things right. But here's the big problem that I have that, you know, I want to talk about with you guys, if you're willing to kind of go there with me.
Sure. Yeah.
Is we hear this a lot. We hear trust the scientist. You know, what does it mean to you guys? You guys are super. I follow you guys. I listen to you guys. Mm. You know, I'm hoping that you'll treat me the same way you treated Professor Scott G. No, I'm just kidding. Kidding about that. I heard Dan go off the other day.
Scott
anyway.
G took a hard right, though, didn't he?
He did, a hard left, I guess.
Yeah. Hard left. Yeah. Well, he's you know, he's BFF with Kara Swisher and all. Anyway, I don't want to go there. But I do want to say you guys are educated people, right? So I say to you, listen to the scientists. We are the party of science. Trust the scientists. What is the coded message that's getting conveyed there? How would you interpret it?
Well, what do you mean? What do you mean when the coded?
What do you think it means when a politician says, "Trust"? I trust the science. I follow the science. I'm the party of science. What is being held? What is science being held up as when someone says, "Trust the science"?
Well, I mean, yeah.
In your opinion, there's no right or wrong answer.
It's a concrete standard of evidence. That's what I say all the time. And what we've lost, because there are no objective media, news media companies anymore. It's like having your pinky on the pick guard of a guitar. It's a placeholder right there, so you know where all the strings are at all times without having to look, right? It's a standard, I guess, under which
I only play the iPhone, so I'll take your word for it.
Right. But that's essentially what it is. When you say trust the science, the presumption is that the science is above reproach and above politics, when in fact that is not the case anymore. We know that very – I mean, yeah. not to get into some – I'm not a – climate change denier, but
no,
they've made a lot of they've made a lot of statements over the last 50 years or so, most of which have been hyperbolic and absolute nonsense in some cases, right? I mean, you can see, you don't have to wait to see the evidence because we've already lived those 50 years. We know exactly whether or not their predictions were true.
Yeah.
And they're not.
Yeah. So that's the whole problem. People, so we've never lived in an age where the average person has so much technology, so much power, and power is technology. I had Michael Saylor, who's like the biggest proponent of Bitcoin in human history, on my show. And he's like, money is power. And I'm like, you're unmarried, no kids. Like, what are you going to do with all, how many yachts can you water ski behind? And he's just like, money is power. And power is the ability to convert energy in a short amount of time to accomplish a given. I'm like, are you forming a mercenary? Like, what are you doing with it? Yeah. And he's like, no, he's actually benevolent. He's starting a university. He actually already did, called Saylor Academy. It's free. He wants to give away a million bachelor's degrees in STEM, not in like, you know, whatever, undersea poetry or whatever. But getting back to the question I asked you guys about science, what I think it's like, and I'm interested in you guys, especially with the military kind of background that you have, Dan, but when I hear trust the scientists, first of all, I don't know a single scientist who trusts scientists. In other words, it's not like I think you're a liar, you cheat on your wife or whatever. No, I just, that's not my job. My job is to verify, not even to trust, because if you trust the scientists, we'd be flat earth, we'd be earth is the center of the universe. We would never have Einstein. And that's actually a demoralizing message to teach to my children. Same with climate change, which I believe in anthropogenic
for sure,
climate change.
I mean, that's obvious.
But if I tell my kids, I'm blessed to have kids. If I say to them, that's it. There's nothing you can do about it. I think back to, like, do you know what the number one problem on Wall Street, the power center of all economics back in the late 1800s, you know what the number one problem was that thought to be crippling effect on the economy was back then?
Jews?
Polio?
I mean, in Germany, it was Jews, to be honest. I'm not making it up. And
I know. But I'm saying Wall Street. The clue is Wall Street. It was horse shit.
Yeah,
it was horseshit, was piling up. The brokers couldn't get in there. So, like, imagine you said, like, the way we're going to solve, you know, the horseshit problem is we're going to, like, you know, have horse diaper, whatever. It was but no, what came along to solve that vexing, you know, possibly existential crisis was science, or it was technology.
Right.
And never have we lived in an age where so much technology is in the control of an ordinary person who has zero comprehension how it works. And therefore, when the words trust science is said, I fear personally, and I'm curious about you guys, I fear it means obey scientists.
Right. I mean, look, your job as a scientist is to question everything, right?
And everything.
I mean, it's we never make progress without that. Now, look, there's got to be some room for the possibility that at some point we arrive at the correct answer on certain things. But we still, like, I mean, for the work you do in cosmic or in the CMB in general, we still have no fucking idea what inflation really is, what happened there, why our universe in 1/32,000th of a second expanded way farther than it should have, and what the implications of that are, and all this stuff. I mean, that's what makes the work you've done so impressive, to be honest. And it's funny that you mentioned, I never really thought about that before, about the tribe getting kind of boxed out, because there have been some notable Nobel, Heisenberg, obviously, Einstein, but Leonard Susskind never got one. And he's the guy that really developed the ideology of string theory that led to M theory later on, right? So it's...
He's a friend of mine. He's been on the show. But
he never even got considered, really, did he? I mean, to be honest.
Well, he's still alive. I mean, there's a lot of problems with the Nobel Prize that I get into in the book, but the most cruel one is this one, which actually benefited one of my close friends now who's won the Nobel Prize, but at the expense of another person. And this was the following fact of the Nobel Prize that I think is the most cruel aspect of it. First of all, it can only go to three people. That's not the cruelest aspect. That's just, like, totally bizarre. It's a relic of 1900 science when the Nobel Prize was established. It was just like a lone genius in his basement working around. Nowadays, I have 300 collaborators on the Simons Observatory project, and I can't do without a single one of them. But the most famous example occurred four years ago now, where we discovered, not we, my experiment, but my friends on the LIGO experiment discovered directly the evidence for what are called waves of gravity.
Right.
So the shuddering, shattering of space-time itself, the reverberations thereof produced when two black holes, each one 30 times the mass of the sun, collide at nearly the speed of light. So just imagine, like, you can't even comprehend it, but it was such a violent explosion. It was a truly universe shaking event that was detected. Okay. Now, that event where these two black holes crashed together, we think it occurred 1.2 billion years ago. Okay? Okay. And these waves travel at the speed of light for 1.2 billion years. So it's 1.2 billion light years, more or less. Now, those signals traveling, if they had arrived 10 days earlier, there's a guy who ended up dying before the awards was made and could have been eligible. He died basically. If the announcement had been made 10 days earlier, he would have won it. And my good friend, Professor Barry Barish at Caltech, he wouldn't have won it because there's only three people that could be allowed to win it.
Right.
So the preclusion against what's called posthumous or after death awards is very cruel because it rewrites science. They now will edit out. Well, his accomplishment really wasn't that important because, you know, and he died, you know, so it's those aspects have caused for the first time, the Nobel Prize Committee, which is the ultimate power broker in science. You think of it as like the Oscars or whatever.
Yeah.
The Oscars are similar in a certain sense, in that they recognize, you know, there's a cabal, there's, you know, people behind the scenes, you don't know who it is. But at least they award it to like 10 people, like any number of people can win it. They get posthumous awards. They do things, ironically, even in the Me Too movement era, yeah, they do things better than science is doing it.
That's true. It is interesting. I think when Steven Weinberg, who's the only name I remember from the Standard Model Nobel yeah. Prize here at Texas mm-hmm. A&M, actually, but he had yeah. there were quite a
UT,
few people.
UT Austin, yeah.
Yeah. Well, was it UT Austin? I thought he was at yeah. was he a professor at A&M for a while, or was it all at Austin?
I think he was at Harvard maybe when he won it, and then he moved okay. to Austin. But he's there at Austin. I actually invited him on my show, and he rejected me like many others.
Really? Really? Well, he's old as shit now, so.
Yeah, he's old. He's up there.
But he's, you know, there were only.
But his BFF did come on the show. The guy by the name of Shelley Glashow.
Mm. Yeah, it was him and two other people that
that's right, yeah.
got the award. But like, I'm sure there were more people. And I wonder when, you know, have there been any Nobel Prizes out of CERN, because there's hundreds of people working there, or Fermilab or any of these other places, right? I mean, there's a lot of people working on these things.
So the Higgs boson, which was famous discovery a few years back, and that actually Weinberg and this guy Abdus Salam, who's so they make contributions. But one of my professors, I went to Brown University for graduate school, one of my best friends, professors, mentors, and heroes was a man by the name of Jerry Guralnick, and he contributed to this discovery. There are actually seven people that were contributed that could have been called their name instead of Peter Higgs. But it turned out Peter Higgs at Edinburgh, he had this like PR machine behind him. It wasn't like his fault. It's like, this is part of what I call the science industrial university complex, where we have like a little discovery, like there might be life on Venus. What is the biggest news in history? And then we got to spin it up because that means there might not be, you know, the biblical interpretation of, you know, it just gets
right.
totally blown up out of control. And then that goes on the front page, as it did with my experiment, Bicep 2, which is behind me in the poster here. Front page of the New York Times for the announcement. And then if and when it is retracted or proven incorrect, inconclusive, maybe even falsified in some cases, it gets printed maybe in section B17 on the Saturday edition. So it's like the public gets this total misapprehension of the way that science works. First of all, press conferences never used to happen. It's like making scientists into celebrities is another part of this industrialization and usefulness of scientists, which I coined a new term. You're familiar with the term useful idiots. Mm. I think scientists sometimes are useful geniuses. Like they are allowing themselves, and my colleagues are allowing themselves to be used for political purposes for short-term gain. In other words, now they'll have the backing of a given political administration, you know, whatever that may be. I'm a political atheist basically, but the point being that when you allow your science to be owned by a political party, or they say we're the party of science, and it distorts the meaning of the word science, which is pure knowledge. That's what the word right. means in Latin, as you guys are, of course, no doubt familiar.
Very,
yeah,
we
whenever we're offline, we only speak Latin.
That's all we do. That's all we do. And vino veritas, by the way. I'm curious as to you. We don't have to get too political on this, but like. With Biden running, right? And he says one of the things that he was running on was believe in science. We're going to believe in the science and the scientists and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to that? Because, you know, for every scientist who has facts and data and figures about one thing, you can always find another scientist who can counter that, right?
Yeah.
Hear phrases like that, is that what you were talking about of like, hey, man, it varies and it's different and we should always challenge it?
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as science. Science is never settled. Science is never case closed. Yeah. Those concepts are human constructs, and scientists are human beings, despite the stereotypes that we're walking Wikipedias and all we care about is facts and data. And, you know, but we're human beings. We want to see our theories, as Dan was saying, confirmed. Like, right. There's just a need for it. And everyone from Einstein to Galileo to Isaac Newton, they all had that.
I mean, Hawking with the information paradox, he really leaned into that one pretty hard.
Totally. I mean, even in black holes and even in what's, you know, so he wrote this most famous book in modern science history called A Brief History of Time. And that book, I reread it. You know, I tried to read it when I was 16. I couldn't understand it.
Right.
You guys think I'm so smart. I still need to sing the alphabet song to remember what comes after Q. But nevertheless, I read that book when I didn't understand. Now I understand it with the swagger of a practicing cosmologist for 30 years. Right.
And so you've said in other interviews, by the way, that you think that Hawking would be like severely depressed if people were still reading his book 100 years from now, unless it was to reference it for like, here's what we used to think, right?
Right.
That's kind of that's the backbone of science, is to constantly be progressive. We don't know shit. Remember that? do you remember what was that movie about the basketball player, the young guy, Pistol Pete Maravich? That movie about him when he was a kid?
Yeah.
That scene where he's in the gym with his dad and his dad's holding a basketball and he goes, this is everything you could possibly know about basketball. Here's what I know. And he draws a big circle on it and he goes, here's what you know. And there's a dot. We don't know shit.
Yeah.
We know some stuff, but we have no fucking idea what the hell's going on out there.
No, and to be fair, Hawking leaned into everything, obviously, because he didn't have a choice. That's a great joke, and I'm gonna catch hell for it. But
fine.
I love R.I.P. Hawking, Stephen Hawking. Big fan, big fan of his second wife too. How he was able to get another wife and just say, you know what, man, I'm in a wheelchair and shit's all fucked up, but I'm gonna divorce you. And then
you know what the secret is though behind how he seduced her?
No, I don't. And I've joked about this for years. What is it actually?
So the way that he did it is ingenious. So, you know, he had this wheelchair and the wheelchair had a speech synthesizer built into it. It turns out his nurse, who later became his wife, when she was previously married to a technician, a student or, you know, colleague of Hawking's, he programmed Stephen Hawking's speech synthesizer, which then was the only modality of communication that he could use to therefore seduce this man's wife.
Oh, that's really
funny. No way.
That's really funny.
There's a new book coming out. I'll put you in touch with the guy if you're interested. It's called Hawking. It's about like what I called, I did an interview with the late great Stephen Hawking's closest collaborator, a guy at Caltech named Leonard Mlodinow. Yeah. And I said, he was kind of a businessman. Like I heard him speak once, literally when I went to an astronomical meeting in London one time in the 90s. And somebody asked him a question, and it was back when he could still move a finger. You know, what he could do with that finger would put you boys to shame. But anyway,
sure.
That finger typed out a response to the following question, which was, Professor Hawking, why did you write this book that it's rumored that no one has ever gotten to the end of, and no one who has can understand it? And Stephen Hawking, I remember him saying, because my daughter needed to pay for college. And I all laughed and everything. But only upon reading, you know, this more recent book about the friendship between Stephen Hawking and this man, Leonard Mlodinow, which I'm looking for here, I did an interview with him, did I realize, you know, and he had to create a corporation. It was basically Hawking Incorporated, this like mythic figure. Because why? And it's not so the guy used to have to be turned in the middle of the night every 2 hours to let this tracheostomy or whatever drain. He needed to have every part of his body wiped, and he would get sores. And towards the end of his life, so he needed cash. He needed to have cash flow. And so part of what he had to do, and this book, Hawking, is about the mythology of it, but maybe a little less tender than I'm presenting it, because, you know, I actually can understand that. Like, if all you have is this hammer and it's your body, or it's your image, then you have to make ends meet. I don't fault him so much for that, although some of the stuff in his books are total bunk. In other words, he had an agenda. His agenda was to disprove the need for God. He said, if God exists, God only has two purposes within the laws of physics. One purpose, to create the universe. The second purpose, to establish the laws of the universe. In A Brief History of Time, I went back and read it. I don't think that very many people could actually understand it. And even my close colleagues who are mentioned in the book by name, the Einstein professor of physics at Princeton University, Paul Steinhardt, you know, we have high level conversations. Our colleagues have no idea what he was saying in that book, was basically assuming that he was right, that the universe didn't have a beginning of time the way that we think about it. In other words, it wasn't like a simple Big Bang where it began right. the way that Genesis 1:1 would suggest. Therefore, he got rid of step number one. Remember I said, he said two things God could do. The first one was start the universe. Nope. Hawking said, my theory, which nobody believes in right now, started the universe. And then to establish the laws of the universe, he used what Dan was saying before, Susskind's M theory. And that's, by the way, that's not proven. There's not a shred of evidence that string theory is right. In fact, many people think it's wrong. Like, actually, well, I mean, look, falsified.
There's this phrase that people like to use. Weinberg's one of them. When the math is so elegant that oftentimes it is true. I mean, that's a kind of a shaky ground to stand on, to be honest.
Yeah,
that whole thing with, one of the most impressive things in all of modern science history that nobody that I've ever met knows about, I'm sure you do, but that conference at USC in 1995 where Ed Witten showed up, everybody's arguing over five different versions of string theory, and he's just like, you guys are all fucking idiots. It's the same thing you're talking about, and here's the proof. And everybody's like, oh, shit. So I like the characterization of Ed Witten as the guy that when physicists need somebody to do math, they call Ed Witten. That's like being the Michael Jordan of math right there, but you don't get a Nike sponsorship for that, unfortunately.
Well, the other guy you guys should have on is my friend Eric Weinstein. I don't know.
We love him. Portals, right? I mean, he's
on the part. Yeah,
he's
one of my best friends. I'll happily send an email. Yeah,
that, but he's that got interview a theory he did of, with Douglas Murray is one of my favorite conversations that I've ever listened to in my life. Honestly, I mean, it's so important
he's
that people
fearless.
Listen to this.
The guy
right
is
now.
Totally fearless. Yeah. He doesn't care. We offend. He's actually a progressive. I mean, he considers himself an old fat, but you know. He's out there. He'll defend like the conservative. He went on Ted Cruz's podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And Michael Knowles. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, these things, there's as much kind of sociology of physics or of astronomy or of any other science as you'll find in the sociology department around the corner. And to think that scientists are unified, monolithic, that is scary, because I think scientists do that because they underestimate. I hate when people say, can you dumb it down for me? No, I'm not going to freaking dumb it down for you. I'm going to treat you like like an adult.
Yeah.
And if you don't understand it, then you got to do some homework or stop wasting my time.
Right.
But I'm never going to insult my audience. And that, to me, is what good scientists should do. They should say, this is complicated, but you have every freaking right. Look, you guys pay my taxes in some part. Your audience is paying my freaking tax. You're my salary, rather. Mm. I wish you guys paid my tax.
No.
You guys' taxes are paying my salary and allowing me to play with toys that, by the way, don't tell Gavin Newsom, my boss, but I would do it for free.
Yeah.
You know, I love my freaking job. I love it. I thrive on it. I always say it's the hardest 3-hour-a-week job in the world. You know, it's the only job where you have like permanent employees. Like, you guys got to earn your money. If you guys don't earn, you know, whatever, the podcast is going to go out of business or whatever, or you know, but
promo codes. Yeah, dude, if I don't
promo codes, yeah, let's do one right now. Yeah, teach me how to get that sweet ghost cash.
Look at that, dude. Did you give me a segue there? ghostbed.com/drinking bros, 40% off the bundle package, kids. 40% off adjustable bases, mattresses, sheets, pillows, you name it. If you throw that adjustable base in there, you will get 40% off. Just type in the promo code Drinking Bros at checkout. You're good to go at ghostbed.com/drinking bros, where, as always, they got a 36-month pay-as-you-go program. No interest there, so you can couple that deal together with the 36-month no interest program, and you walk out of here with this whole bed you see in front of you for $35 a month, which is crazy, because typically most mattress places don't do that. I don't know why they don't, but I also don't know why GhostBed's giving away 40%. That seems crazy. Go to ghostbed.com/drinking bros today. Next up, we got a new one here that we've been working on for a while. This is capsule.com, CAPSULE.com. And when you hear it, you're probably thinking, oh, well, it's drugs. Well, it is drugs. Going to the pharmacy is the goddamn worst. And you always dread about running out of your prescription. And you're like, man, is the doctor open? Is the pharmacy open? What am I gonna do with my kids? What am I gonna do with dinner? Whatever it is. Now you don't have to. Capsule is a new kind of pharmacy that hand delivers your prescription the same day for free. Here's how Capsule works. It's super easy. You go to capsule.com. It only takes 15 seconds to sign up. When your prescription is ready, Capsule will text you to schedule free delivery at the time you choose. Then the Capsule courier hand delivers your medication to your door straight from the pharmacy in a tamper-proof package. It's totally secure. And if you have any questions, you can call, text, or email with an expert pharmacist. It's that simple. No more waiting in line. No more driving to the pharmacy. No more forgetting refills. Best of all, even though it is a way better experience, Capsule doesn't cost any more than your old pharmacy. They've got over 6,000 five-star reviews. Right now, they're available in New York and all the surrounding tri-state areas, Austin, which is where we're at, Boston, Chicago, the Twin Cities, and Los Angeles, and other cities are coming soon. Capsule accepts all major insurance and is currently available in all the cities that I just mentioned. So it's there. It's already there, and it's moving across America pretty quickly. To sign up, visit capsule.com to get your prescription hand delivered today for free. That is Capsule, C-A-P-S-U-L-E.com. I have it. They just drop it off at the fucking house. Today, if I don't have shit just dropped off to my house, I'm pissed off about it. Last but not least today is feels.com. Another one that just gets dropped off of your house. F-E-A-L-S.com. CBD. Edibles. Droplets. My wife uses it every single night to go to sleep. A lot of people use CBD for aches and pains. We say the same things on this show every time. Drinkables. Best is KillcliffCBD.com. If you're doing edibles or droplets, it is feels.com. Some people don't like drinkables, man, because they don't want the fucking carbonation and all that shit in their body. These droplets are super fucking easy, man. Go to feels.com today to get in on this. We've had a lot of CBD companies hit us up over the years. The only two we can actually vouch for are feels.com and Killcliff. So I wouldn't try anything else, man. There's a lot of weird, like, fucking head shops on the side of the road that you're like, oh, man, it's got CBD. Or you go to the gas stations, it's got CBD in it. And you're like, man, what the fuck else is in that? Don't trust it. Just take a few drops of feels under your tongue and you're good to go. This shit actually works. And when it shows up, you're like, holy shit, this is classy as fuck. Feels has had me and my wife feeling our best every single day. And it can really help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/drinkingbros. That is feels.com/drinkingbros. We have our own URL. And you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That is feals.com/drinkingbros. To become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/drinkingbros is where you can go. And we're actually on a subscription. So it just shows up once a month. That way I don't have to fucking enter in my credit card information and all that other bullshit. It's great. That is feels.com/drinkingbros. I appreciate it, Brian. Thank you for that kind segue. Not only are you one of the smartest dudes on the planet, you gave me a fucking sponsor segue.
I'm learning from you guys. I listen to you guys. You guys are my professors. Well, by the way, you ever notice, and like, you know, one thing that really pisses professors off, you ever watch, you know, like one of these pornographic movies? You never do that. Okay.
No, so, no, but no. I was actually watching porn 5 minutes before we started this interview.
Yeah, that's why it was late.
Yeah.
Did you see him clearing his pockets? It was like, hey, man, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know that most of the so-called professors in the pornographic movies, they don't have tenure?
Really? That's a problem in academia right now, though, because what people don't know is that over the last 30 years or so, the professor salaries commensurate to inflation have risen by about 27%. The administrative fees have risen by 2,000%.
Yeah.
So if you're bitching about your student loans, don't blame him. Blame those cunts that run the university. Not that you're calling them that. I am.
Yes.
I call everybody cunts, even my friends.
No, I know you do. I know you do. Yeah, I was waiting for that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was waiting for that. I thought the C word was going to be CMB there, Dan. But
well,
no.
I mean, you know, cosmic microwave background.
Well,
cunts.
let me say something about that because it is true. And actually, we're getting more and more, you know, kind of course load. We're getting more and more students that we have to teach. The universities are growing. Like, how do you differentiate between UCSD and UT Austin, like, or UT Texas A&M? Like, do I know some special physics, or does Harvard Stanford know some special physics that UCSD hasn't learned yet? No, frick no. You know, I mean, I went to the best, you know, Ivy League schools or whatever. But the point is that you have to differentiate yourself via the different perks you offer. Like, we have ocean view dorms here. You know, you guys come and visit, I'll show you our ocean view dorm. Like, some freshman is moving in, or you know, whatever. They're looking out to the sea. Like, I went to undergraduate in Cleveland. You know, I was at Case Western Reserve University, a proud Spartan. And you know, what's so interesting, and you guys will know this so much better than I do, because I'm in San Diego, and until this last year, the Padres hadn't made the playoffs in the last 17 years. But I'm told that it's very difficult to get into the major leagues. Like, it's very difficult, right? How hard is it to get into AAA? It's also pretty hard, right?
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, it's easy. So in academia, you may not know this, because I don't expect that non-academics would know this. To be a professor is kind of like the major league. In fact, there are more people in the major league. There's the same number of players in the NBA as there are professors of cosmology. Maybe it's twice as many in the NBA as professors that do what I do that are tenured. It could be even more. So, but the level below me, the analog of AAA ball, is called being a postdoctoral scholar. Mm-hmm. So this is after you get your PhD, you want to show that you can do original research, new information. You want to be independent of your graduate student advisor, who's kind of like a mentor, kind of like a father or mother figure, whatever. And that then takes you to a level where you can say, I could be that professor. Now I could be a, it is as easy, you can walk down the street and almost get a postdoc. Like, we're desperate. I'm hiring, trying to hire like 5 to 10 different people to do a postdoctoral research gig in my lab. So now imagine that, though. Imagine it was like simple to get into the AAA and impossible. It's a totally bizarre, out of market force environment. And the whole academy is turned upside down because of forces like that. And because of, yes, the bloating and the bureaucracy that we have to participate in, to, in part, to differentiate ourselves from the Harvards, from the Caltechs and Stanfords.
Right. Yeah. Look, you're always going to go through things like that, unfortunately. I think, you know.
Well, it's like it's almost like a reverse creative destruction. It's like mission creep almost. Like this. Mm. I mean, it happens in anything. In sociology and government, there's always bloat. There's always unnecessary bureaucracy that gets added in, like intersectionality, which is something that Douglas Murray and Weinstein have had a lot of conversations about that I've listened to. We've decided that we're going to break every single human being down into all their elements. Then we're going to create this sophisticated but kind of vague hierarchy of which elements, like if you're gay, you're up here, but if you're straight, you're down here, and then all this stuff. And we turn people into the sum of all their individual parts instead of worrying whether or not they're a good fucking person or not. You know what I mean? It's nonsense.
And you know, if you're rich or if you have the right connections, you can cut the line and get your problems solved faster. I mean, you said you're a fan of the Padres. Does Garth Brooks really need to play a spring training game, for Christ's sakes? Like, no, but he's fucking rich enough and powerful enough that they were like, yeah, let's trot his fat ass out at shortstop and let him play a couple innings.
Well, he looked pretty good at the inauguration, though.
Well, look, he sounded great, too, but he shouldn't be playing shortstop for the Padres
no, he played
in any
base.
Spring
Come
training
on.
Game. No, I think it was shortstop, right?
Oh, he definitely should not be playing over there.
Yeah, the hot corner. No, that's
and they lobbed in a 82 mile an hour to let him hit it, you know, up the middle once and make him feel great about himself. But it's the same way with any profession, though, where, you know, if you're rich or have the right connections, you can cut the line. I'm sure if you're friends with Gavin Newsom, like you personally in real life, right?
My buddy, yeah.
Yeah, your buddy.
My boss. My boss.
You'd
be
eating at French Laundry and talking about the new budget that you're going to have for your department and all the people you'd be able to hire. But chances are you're probably not bros with him, so you're stuck like the rest of us assholes, right?
Yeah. But yeah, that's right. Yeah. So for me, yeah, those kinds of things are the reason that I want to go in academia, because I said it is a meritocracy.
Right.
And you know, it's hard, guys, because what Dan was just saying, like, you want to pigeonhole somebody. Do you know why we want to do that? It's because we like shortcuts. We like
we're
hacks.
Lazy, yeah.
We're lazy. Yeah. And so if I can sum you up and say, oh, you're black or you're a Jew, like I can say this or that. And people will say to me, even my ultra conservative friends, you know, I've had on the podcast, Heather McDonald, who's like, she's like one of the most courageous people in the world. She's like, do you really think, like, when people, when they're choosing the Nobel Prize, they say, well, we shouldn't give it to this black man. Like, no African-American has ever won the Nobel Prize in physics. And so, do you really think that? And I'm like, do you think that science has changed and that scientists have changed in 100 years,
right.
80 years, 70 years? Because you know what, Heather, back when, you know, back 50, 70 years ago, they wouldn't give it to people of my ethnicity, of my right. religious persuasion. Yeah. What makes you think that scientists have changed and now they're like altruistic and they're not? No, of course. By the way, you know how many women have won it? There's one kind of behind me. There's only four women in history who have won it. Two of them
Mary
are
Curie's got to be one of them, right?
She won the very first in 1903. And then it was a drought until one of the professors here at UC San Diego, Maria Mayer,
she won it
in 1963. And by the way, when she won it, the San Diego Union Tribune, the newspaper, the headline was San Diego Housewife Wins Nobel Prize.
Oh, boy.
Oh, well, you know what our headline is going to be for this show, obviously. Christ, Nobel dude. Prize loser, Brian Keating.
And that's going to be special guest.
Because that way, you know, in the search engine and all that stuff, it'll pop up.
People say, oh, you're a liar. You know, you just have sour grapes, Keating, because you didn't win it. But the interesting thing, unlike, you know, like a kind of a zero sum game, like science is an infinite game. Like you can't get to the end of it.
Yeah, there's no finish line.
Yeah.
So it is. I guess it is.
You're done with science.
It is somewhat intrinsically difficult to decide what is and isn't important. It's like art almost. I mean, who knew in 69, whenever Susskind started putting out papers on string theory. And of course, that was extrapolations on hadrons from Heisenberg's earlier work. But nobody really knew what the fuck he was talking about at the time. They didn't understand how important it was. And maybe it turns out after all these years that it isn't important, right? Whenever somebody comes up with the TOE or somehow unifies the quantum world with the fucking macro world, and we decide, oh, that was cool at the time, but we don't care about that anymore. I wonder how many Nobel Prizes for physics especially have become irrelevant. Like the information has become irrelevant over time.
There are some that are given out that are totally wrong. And there are some that are given out that led to like evil being, perpetrated on Earth. I'll give you an example, Dan. You might know this, but there was a famous Jewish German man in the 1900s named Fritz Haber. And because of Fritz Haber, you and I can have a drink of Scotch whiskey. We can eat our breakfast in the morning because almost half of the fertilizer for half of the food on Earth is made from the process that he invented called the Haber-Bosch process. Right. Anyway, it's called nitrogen. There's a lot of nitrogen in the atmosphere, but fertilizer needs to take that nitrogen out and put it into a chemical form that plants can metabolize.
Right.
And that process he invented. Well, he invented another chemical molecule, and it went by the name of Zyklon B. And actually in 1915, rather, he advocated and personally suited up for battle in World War I in the deployment of chemical weapons and chlorine gas against the Allied troops, killed 50,000 people on the Allied side. This guy, 3 years later, went on to win the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
And so you think, like, there's no morality that's associated with science. That's the thing I want to get across. I'm doing a video for Prager University. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, caused half my fans to like send me hate mail. And, I've already done two. I did one with Michael Knowles last week about Galileo, which we can chat about because it's really fun. He's an interesting guy if you want to ever get in touch with him. Mm-hmm. But the subject that I was talking about is like you have all these scientists, but the word science, it means knowledge. It has nothing to do with wisdom. You know, they say like knowledge is knowing a tomato is a freaking fruit. But wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of unintended consequences. I mean, I would imagine pretty much everybody that worked on the Manhattan Project at some point, except for maybe the Nazis that were involved in that.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, we probably should have done that. Shit.
Yeah. I mean, even when, you know, Fritz Haber won in 1918, it was for chemistry. And it was like, dude, you used it to kill thousands and thousands of people. Like, how do you get an award for that?
Well, I mean, the Time Person of the Year isn't always the best person of that year. I think Osama bin Laden was the Time Person of the Year once, right?
Yeah.
Whomever the most, I mean, and in that way, Time got it right. Like, that was the most influential figure of that year, and that's the point of that award. Unfortunately, it's become, like we discussed, a curated process. Mm-hmm. And you can't, I mean, it's honestly, I am a capitalist. I get it, man. But you cannot, there's certain things that you just simply cannot introduce profit motive into. Things that are necessary for us to continue living and building and progressing our society cannot have an intrinsic profit motive to it. I'm not saying you can't make money off of it, but if the entire point becomes to leverage whatever influence or technology or whatever you have just to make money, then it becomes a runaway effect at some point, right? It gets off the rails. We have this bloated, we have the student loan crisis, or we have, you know, people that are making science
the Nobel
political.
Prize.
The Nobel Prize.
The Nobel Prize is the biggest export of Sweden, you know, like Volvos and the Nobel Prize. It's
they also make the javelin, which is a surface to air.
Did they make Greta Thunberg? Was she Swedish?
She's Norwegian.
Norwegian.
Well, you can.
But that's better. Yeah, that's better for her because the Norwegians give out the Peace Prize, and the Swedes give out the other
now,
ones.
Do you think, so what are the chances that a homogenous society like Sweden is doing a lot in the field of progressive politics, like understanding that Northern Europe isn't the only place on Earth and that there's people other than white people that they should probably pay attention to at some point? Probably not a good chance of that, right?
No, not anytime soon.
They don't give a shit.
Yeah,
they don't care.
Although Iowa's basketball team is still under that same guise.
I don't care about Iowa. I don't
starting white five. Starting five. I've never seen that.
I don't believe.
Century.
Well, Princeton.
You're right.
But I don't believe that Iowa exists.
No, and it doesn't. Ohio State beat them last night and proved that theory yet again. For you personally, though, one of our co-hosts, Jared Taylor, who is not here.
Where's JT?
Well, he's probably got a coli or who knows.
No, his daughter's in the hospital, actually.
Okay, yeah. So it's legit.
Did he
run her over with a motorcycle?
No, she's got a staph infection from getting scratched by a cat or some shit. Who knows?
Okay. I mean, it's wild animal on his own property. But he's said this on this show numerous times. Especially with the military, and I think it relates to your field as well. He thinks they should give more awards away, same with the Nobel Prize. So that way, like young scientists or people that are coming up in the military have something else to look up to and aspire to and achieve. When there's only three in your craft, right?
Yeah.
That's just not enough to be like, man, it doesn't seem like an achievable goal when you set out there. Like, you know, we were discussing the New York Times bestseller list earlier. At least there's 15 slots. So, you know, per week, there's 15 chances, and then there's different categories of it. And you're like, all right, I thought it was possible growing up.
Right.
But then, you know, when you achieve it, it is.
You're right. It doesn't seem
very... But let me ask you a question, Ross,
because
this is important. I've got friends that are best, you know, like Michael Knowles wrote this blank book, and it was number one. Ben Shapiro is a friend of mine. But, you know, I've never really asked him that. And I want to ask, like, the day after you got on that list, or a week after you got on, like... You're back on the horse. You're not like saying, "Oh, I won it." And actually, there's an old joke in the Nobel Prize that the Nobel Prize is a ticket to your funeral because you never do anything important after you win.
Right. Yeah.
Because people think of you as this ultra genius. And then, but I want to ask you another question. Like, so let's just stipulate that the Nobel Peace Prize is rotten and corrupt to its core, right? I mean, first of all, from an objective perspective, who has caused the most peace on planet Earth? What organization
caused the most peace?
Has allowed for most people, not saying it's perfect, but what entity on earth, you know, from all different organizations, the World Health Organization, you know, whatever you want, has created the benefit of mankind, the most peace on earth?
It's so hard to say. And here's why, because everybody's backed by funding that is for a certain motive that, like, you wonder why they're doing it. It's kind of like meeting somebody in real life and you're like, man, why is that person so nice? Why is that the nicest person I've ever met? Most of the time it's because they're not influenced by anything else. Therefore,
you don't know too many New York Jews.
Huh? Well, yeah. I actually know a lot. They're all my reps. Yeah. Agents, managers, lawyers, everything. But, that's Hollywood, baby.
Shabbat shalom, by the way.
Yeah.
Not yet. We got a couple hours. Calm down.
But
no, you're right. But
people
who are influenced
by anything. So that asking me that question of who has caused it or what organization has caused it, it's really tough to say because it's also what people believe in, right? Because there's certain people who believe in a religion, so therefore they don't do certain things or things like that. But I don't know.
I think the U.S. military, I'm just going to say it. The U.S. military, just by fact, you know, when they show up, people know they're not corrupt. They're not going to kill people. You know, that we operate by some code, and we've never won it once. The Red Cross has won it like three or four times. You know, terrorists have won it. Yasser Arafat won it. You know, Kissinger won it. Now, I'm not saying we're perfect, but if you were objectively about people, but I want to ask a deeper question. Why does humankind care about this little 3-inch piece of, this is actually Hanukkah gelt, by the way. It's not actually a golden medallion. It's a piece of chocolate. But but why do we care about it? Like, why is it? And I found it very interesting, and I explore this in my book, that you guys, and I never proselytize. I'm not, it's not against my religion technically to proselytize. Don't take it the wrong way, but I'm like, everybody has a religion. Even if you're like Richard Dawkins, that's your religion. Lawrence Krauss, you know, these are people that are devout. They just don't happen to, they have a secular religion that they adhere to, and that's fine. I've actually spoken at this, you know, secular, agnostics meetings and so forth. But
to be honest, most modern Jews are secularists, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
It's cultural religion, yeah.
Yeah,
but exactly. It is, like you said, it is a religion of a sort. I mean, it's a lot of people will use phrases and they're, you know, I guess in some ways tongue in cheek or even sometimes kind of irritating. But like, my religion is love. But that is a possibility, right? I consider my personal religion to be the fucking like truth and empathy. Those are the only two things that really matter to me, because it's the only that's the only things that really make human beings progress. Like having all the information and realizing that no matter what that information says, we still have a duty to take care of each other. Those are the only things in life really that even matter.
And those resonate with but my point is, like, when I meet somebody who says I'm an agnostic, how do they distinguish themselves? Like, if an alien, just somebody from space who's super smart, which we should talk about aliens, by the way, too. But anyway, an alien looks at Earth and sees Brian Keating, and I call myself an agnostic. But then he looks at Richard Dawkins, and Richard Dawkins is an atheist, and he doesn't do anything. But Brian Keating doesn't go to church, doesn't go to temple, doesn't go to mosque, whatever. And how would you functionally distinguish yourself, Dan, from someone who is like, do you have any rituals? Do you have any? And I'm not saying like denigrating at all. I'm just saying, how do you functionally? Because I'm a behaviorist. I believe that your behavior shape your attitude, that your rules outperform your tools, whatever you want to say. And so like, how do you instantiate your religion, which I'm not grappling with what you're saying at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's principles, right? For us, that's the way, at least I organize my life. And when I say principles, not necessarily like Ray Dalio's book, but we do one of our other shows, my other show with Dakota Meyer, it's called American Party Podcast. The idea is to be, as you said, politically agnostic, right? But it's not politically agnostic. It is a realization that these polar opposites can't possibly both be right, right? And there's a very small chance that either one of them is right on everything. Actually, there's no chance that either one of them is right on everything. And there's even a small chance that they're right on anything at all, because it's so politicized at this point. So the principles are things that should be ubiquitous, right? Like, anybody should be able to apply that to their life and it works, because we are all, you know, despite cultural differences and things like that and experience, we are essentially the same. We have Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? We have, we need food and shelter and safety and all this bullshit. The way I would say principles is the way I do it. So principles like, I'm going to do something, and there's so much context that is required to answer that question. Like, what is important to you? What's important to me is that I influence things in a positive way at the lowest possible level I can first, and then work my way upward. Right. So deal with your family first, then your tribe, then your state, you know, then your country, then the world. Right. Yeah. Because that's why that's why I really like the 10th Amendment. Not because I'm anti-tax necessarily, but it's because as a voter and as a taxpayer, let's say I spend $10,000 a year on taxes. If I spend the bulk of that at the city level, that means my tax dollars have the most influence that they possibly could have, because that is the place where I live most of my life, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important thing that happens. So in context, I would say it depends on people's value. What's important to you? You know what I mean? Right. And what's important to us is shaped largely by our experience. Like Ayn Rand, for example, is super anti-everything that has anything to do with anybody controlling anything, regulating anything, but that's because she grew up under a situation where everybody was controlling every single moment of her life, right? So we overreact to things like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know the answer, but to me, it's prioritizing whatever I can do, you know, to make the world better, whether it's shooting terrorists in the fucking face, or whether it's, you know, giving a sandwich to some dude on the side of the road.
Right.
Right. So I don't know how to really
No, I think it's, you know, Judaism's concept is like, you know, perfecting the world, tikkun olam, but those like, you have to have, I'm a pilot, as I said, you know, if you are going to the moon, you know, if you, how big do you think the moon is? Like, if the whole sky is 360 degrees around, how big do you think the moon is in degrees? Do you guys know?
14 by 14.
No,
14 degrees by 14 degrees.
Yeah. No, I've
absolutely wrong.
I have no idea.
In degrees out of 360, probably like 30 degrees, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. That's like 100 times too big. It's half of 1 degree. Oh, it's actually the same size as your fingernail. So hold your fingernail out tonight.
True, yeah.
The moon's out. The moon subtends us, and it's the same size as the sun. So I'm not, you know, as an astronomer, I'm saying go out, look at the sun with your naked eye, maybe with a telescope. I'm not saying that for all the disclaimers out there, all the people that are going to this. But when you think about it, if you're off, that means if you're off by a quarter of it, let's say you're trying to hit the center of the moon exactly with a bullet or a laser or whatever. If you're off by a quarter of a degree, you'll miss the whole freaking moon.
Right.
So like, you got to get on track early on. And like, for me, I don't know if you guys are parents. I'm not aware.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you set your kids off, like I've been thinking a lot about this with my kids, and you know, there's this cliche that people say, like, time is the most valuable of all commodities. And I say, no, it's not. And they'll say, well, yes, it is, because you can't make time back. You can make money back. I'm like, actually, innocence is the most perishable of all quantities, of, in my opinion. I don't know what you guys think. I'm curious. But because, like, and it could be innocence of, like, your kid is just, like, this beautiful, innocent thing. It comes into the world with, like, no prior Bayesian, you know, kind of influence on what the world is about. But, or it could be, like, like the other day, my wife told me, she kind of says, did you hear about these cops that were killed in Florida? I'm like, I don't need to know that. Like, I know that that is possible. There's absolutely nothing that I can do. I'm not going to, like, now I'm going to sound really smart around the faculty. No, I wish I was innocent of that fact. It does me no good. So my thought is, like, we should be innocent. And like, you guys have done stuff that you can't not have, you know, some residual from. But on the same token, it doesn't mean that going forward, you can't preserve whatever innocence that is. Now, you guys work in the news, but, you know, whatever. So it's a little harder for you. But that gives you the power of directing your attention to those things that really matter and paying attention to that, so that you don't have to be innocent when things like evil or whatever come about. That's my philosophy.
Well, I've spent my life being the opposite of innocent. And I don't mean that in, like, I am a dirtbag.
No,
for
I know.
Sure.
Yeah.
But like, the bulk of my adult life has been spent doing harsh things to other people. But I do feel like I could see that from your perspective. Like, I would appreciate being able to make sure that other people were able to do what you're talking about. That's not in the cards for me, obviously, because it's not,
no, I know
that's not my experience or who I am as a person, but it is nice. I mean, that's the whole thing. When people say, thank you for your service, that is something that military people have a very hard time responding to, because they don't know what to say to that.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I know my brother-in-law is in Force Recon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's been in Afghanistan 21 times.
Yeah. It's hard to respond to that. Like, what do you say? So what I've been saying lately is, thank you for being worth fighting for. Make sure you continue to be that, right?
That's
because ultimately, we all give up something somewhere to make other people's lives better, whether we know it or not, right?
Yeah.
If it's taxes or it's sacrifice, you're a cop, you're a teacher, you're a nurse, you're any of these, you're just a mentor to some fucking kid in your neighborhood when you're a teenager even. I mean, there's so many different things like that. So yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah, and
Ross, what about you? Are you like religious of any way?
Yeah, to go over kind of the last three, you know, questions you brought up here, you know, with religion and awards and innocence and what the most valuable thing we have is, all of that changed when I had children. So, you know, religion in particular, was raised Catholic, you know, received communion, all that other stuff.
As I got older,
I was in the C&E crowd, you know, Christmas and Easter. And then after that, stopped going to church. Not because, you know, I didn't believe in anything that was going on or blah, blah, blah. But how do you disprove everybody else's religion and say that that's wrong?
Hitchens' razor. What can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. That's how. It's not on you to prove a negative. I'll say that.
Correct. And that's what I believe in. Therefore, for me personally, to practice any form of organized religion anymore didn't really make sense when I don't know the answer. Therefore, I also don't look down on people who believe in whatever they believe in, right? Mm-hmm. Unless it's doing harm to others. And with my children, I think that I'm going to lean that same way. In regards to like awards and stuff, why it was so important.
Sorry, Ross, will you expose your kids? Because I do feel like, and this is something that like Dawkins will say, he's like, no kid is born Christian. Like, it's child abuse to say your child when it's born is Christian. Whereas Jews is different because Jews is like an ethnicity and kind of racial. But I'm curious. Because I feel like if you don't expose my parents are both, you know, pretty devout atheists, even though they were both Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I actually went through and I became an altar boy in the Catholic Church when my mom remarried. And then I was an atheist. And then I became a practicing Jew, not Orthodox, but practicing.
Right.
But anyway, I'm curious, because if you don't, I feel like I expose my kids to religion of their birth. And yeah, of course, I changed my religion 3 times, you know, whatever. But if you don't, if you go in the beginning and just like, there's no, like, no kid is going to come up with like, oh, there was this person who died for my sin. You know, like, it's just not possible for a kid to do that any more than it was possible for Einstein to come up with theory of relativity when he was 5.
Right. So therefore, if my kids are curious about it and they want to learn and or know or have questions about it, I am happy to point them in that direction if that's what they want. Me personally, as a parent, to try to pick an organized religion for them, that one's a tough one for me personally.
Well, what's the point of doing that? Because I mean, it's actually one of the great confluences of nature and nurture. The decision of young adults to choose a religion. It's one of the most fascinating things that ever happens in someone's life.
And I don't want to set them on a path where they feel like they have to follow one because mom and dad wanted them to.
You also don't want the abstinence-only fucking sex education, right?
Right.
Yes.
Like, you don't want the ignorance involved there, because they're going to make a bad decision. They're going to get tricked into some weird cult bullshit at some point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's so religion, as Brian said, it's so pervasive in our society, whether it's called religion or not. I mean, Joe Rogan's religion is fucking DMT and fucking elk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's nonetheless a religion, right?
Yeah.
So it is what it is. So yeah, I think like for personally, my first degree is in comparative religion. I don't believe in any of this shit, but it is a great way to understand the human mind. It's also really good to understand nuance and how we think about things and the constant struggle we've made to understand our purpose, whether there is one or not, right? I think that's really important, because it reflects so much on us. The gods that we create reflect so much on us and where we were at the time period.
That's right.
I think it's fascinating, right?
Yeah.
Why would you not study that? Like, I think it's important for children to be exposed and study that, because they'll never know human beings better than human beings involved in religion, particularly in the creation and progression of religion.
Right.
Which is why I studied it.
But I also want them to have their own curiosity and interest in it. To pick any one organized religion, to me personally as a parent, is tough, because then I'm telling them essentially, all right, well, this is what I studied and you should study this and blah, blah, blah.
But to Dawkins' point, he does make a good point. If he thought this, there's this anecdote, I think it's in... God, I don't remember which book it's in, but he talks about how when he was like 12 or 13 years old, he was like, shit, if I was born in Egypt, I'd probably be Muslim. So is there really any real intrinsic value to the fact that I was raised in the Church of England? Probably not.
Right.
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 Like, that isn't, it's not that there's no value there. It's that that's not proof that it's real.
No, not proof that it's real, but you guys were born in America. Also, your life would be different in a whole host of ways, a part of which is religion. But, you know, what's curious to me is like, so what I like about Judaism is that the word Israel, I don't know if you guys know this, but the word Israel, like El means like Eloheinu, means God, and Yisrael means fight. It means fight with God. And that's kind of noble. Like Islam, I love it. You know, one of the best, I rank on academia a lot, but one of the best things about academia is literally, guys, I have students in Antarctica. I have students from Central Africa that were Muslim. I have Saudi Arabian. I've got kids from Northwest Washington State, whatever. I get to meet people from all cultures all over. And you know who else gets to meet them? My family, when they come over to my house. Mm. Different cultures. I go to their house. I go to their lands and I learn about them. You know, Islam is lovely and wonderful, and I have great friends and great Islam means submission, right? Right. I mean, you guys know that.
Yeah.
Submit to what, right? So submit. So I'd rather be fighting with God and not knowing, because I think as a scientist, my obligation is, as we said earlier, it's to question everything. And that does mean I don't just, everything, you know, it makes this nice little package. No. I'm going to fight against it. But the key point is, like, as Elie Wiesel said, he said, a Jew can be without God. A Jew can be, you know, angry at God or loving God, but he can't be without thinking about God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the word, the Hebrew word for death actually means, absence of God, right? Basically, like the separation between yourself and God, basically, is what it means.
But
right?
doesn't that drive you crazy as a scientist and as a, you know, a professor of cosmology? You'll never have that answer.
No, only if you think that it's a fucking race with a finish line.
Yes.
And it's not.
The infinite game. It's an infinite frontier.
I mean, look, there is, you're born and like, then you die. Why, are you worried that you're not going to find the answers before you die?
Look, Einstein fucking probably led himself to an early grave trying to find a theory of everything. Right?
That's right.
He wanted it so badly, and there was no way. He didn't have the equipment to be able to measure these things. And that's also one of the reasons it took him a longer time to get his Nobel Prize. But either way.
What's funny about him is that, you know, he came up with seven things that were each worthy of a Nobel Prize.
Right.
And he won one Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
There's a woman by the name of Rita Hayworth, who was like an actress in the 50s. And she won like six or seven Oscars. And you're like, shouldn't there be a correlation? Like, shouldn't there be, if it's meritocratic, shouldn't someone who's super brilliant enough to win a Nobel Prize be more likely than not to win another Nobel Prize? And yet the opposite is true. And so there's some extra forces that are at work. And so I don't judge things. The only reason I want to bring that, and maybe we can do a part two. I gotta teach a bunch of students in 6 minutes, but I do want to do a part two with you guys. But the thing I want to leave you guys with is like, what is your idol? For me, and I'm very candid, I got F-18s from Miramar taking off right now. I love those guys.
Yeah,
those are my boys over there.
Hornets,
Top Gun, and but what I want to leave you with, and the listeners out there, is this quest that I'm on. It's a continuous quest, and we don't fight the current. You want to conserve energy, but what is your idol? What are you living to impress?
The truth has got to be the idol, right? Like if you believe what you believe and what I believe, that there's no way we're going to solve all these things in one lifetime, then it becomes incumbent upon you not just to work as hard as you can in this lifetime, but also to make sure you're passing your knowledge on, and there's some kind of baton being handed off to the next generation. It's so important for that to happen.
Absolutely. And I feel like, you know what that is? That's the dream of 1,000 generations. Yeah. It's time travel. Yeah. It's teleportation. I don't know, Dan, do you have kids? I forgot.
No, none that I'm
aware of. You are a mentor to millions of people, and you can be a father figure as well. So Ross and me and you can teleport. We can teleport our values into the future. That's something that Elon Musk would kill to do, his body. But who cares about your body, right? Your body is dust and ashes. What is your most important characteristic is what's inside. And that's what you can teleport today for the future.
Right. Yes. And mine, it's curiosity. And every single day, and I've said this numerous times on the show, that's why I love doing podcasts every single day, is because I get to meet people that I would never get to meet in all walks of life, including you. Our next guest was just pardoned by President Trump. He's got a crazy story. and it's that curiosity that I never want to lose. Therefore, I'm not really chasing an idol. I'm more or less chasing an endless pursuit to stay curious every single day in life. Mm. And hopefully there isn't an end point where I'm like, man, I figured it all out and I'm all done and I'm just going to play.
There's actually a really good episode of Futurama about this, where he discovers the theory of everything, Professor Farnsworth does, and he becomes deeply depressed, right?
Yes.
And then then there's another type of matter and he's like, oh, what's this type of matter? And he gets happy again because there's something else to pursue.
There's
right?
something else to be curious about.
You know what I mean?
That's
Otherwise, what the fuck are we doing here, man? I mean, if there's no curiosity, no progress, then we're just chess pieces on a board.
I agree. And since you've got to teach, we have this thing called the Drinking Bro of the Week, which is someone who has inspired you or helps you become the person you are today. Before you get out of here to go mold the young minds of the next great generation, who would you like to give the Drinking Bro of the Week to?
I'll give it to a man who had a vineyard of his own in his own home prison, Galileo Galilei. He was in prison, but it's the kind of prison that Bernie Madoff would literally kill for. I had the honor of hosting a conference there in 2015. And Galileo studied, grew his own grapes, and he had a famous saying. He said, the sun goes around in the sky, or we go around it, however you like. And it still takes its time to ripen a cluster of grapes so that we can enjoy a drink or two together as friends.
Cheers.
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 Boys, Shabbat Shalom. It's great to meet you.
You as well. Check out Losing the Nobel Prize by Brian Keating. It is available everywhere. Where else can they find you, Brian?
So I got a podcast called the Into the Impossible podcast. Everywhere you get podcasts, I get great people like Ben Shapiro, Eric Weinstein, Noam Chomsky. So I'm kind of like you guys. I achieve neutrality by going so far back and forth to the left and emulating what you guys are doing. And then on YouTube, I'm Dr. Brian Keating, growing a following there. Twitter, Dr. Brian Keating. That's about it.
Awesome. Thank you for your time today. We definitely got to do a part two, man. You're an unbelievably fascinating guy, and we'd love to have you back.
Let's do it. Maybe when the Nobel Prizes are awarded in the fall, we can do another one. I'm doing a book about lessons from laureates, what we can learn from these top performers. So maybe we'll get together in person.
Yeah. Yes. Anytime. Come down to Austin, Texas. We would love to have you for sure.
I love it. All right, brothers.
Awesome. For Brian Keating, D'Anthony Holloway, I'm Ross Patterson. This is the Drinking Bros Podcast. Good night, everyone.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.